From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, the latest in Facebook's ongoing, never-ending, kind of insane and impossible to follow privacy saga. Then I'll be chatting later with Gary Hustwit, the director of a new documentary about the designer Dieter Rams, who, even if you've never heard of the guy, I guarantee you've seen the products he made or influenced, like every Apple product ever. And we've all got some last-minute gift ideas because it's December 21st, and I think that qualifies as last minute. But first, let's talk about Amazon. If you've ever bought something on Amazon, you probably read reviews on the site first. But those reviews, as Joanna Stern found, may not be what you think. So joining me as always to talk about all this stuff, Christopher Mims in Baltimore and Joanna Stern in our New York studio. Hi, friends.
Hi.
Mims, where are you? We didn't play the Where in the World is Christopher Mims game last week, and I missed it terribly.
I've created a new little lounge space for us to record in. It's fantastic.
Who's us?
The two of you who are in my ears.
Oh, when you said like you made it us, like I just pictured like you're with your dog and your gerbil or something.
Joanna, did you just ask if he has a gerbil?
Yes.
Everyone has a gerbil. All we know is there's something else in the room right now, but we don't know exactly what. Okay, so let's talk about Amazon. So between, I mean, everybody's bought something on Amazon. That's like pretty straightforward, right? And I feel like whenever I'm going to buy something, there's a million versions of each thing, and you just decide between them by looking at how many reviews they have and whether they're good and kind of use that to decide. But what I feel like a lot of people don't realize, I certainly didn't, the extent of it until I read this piece that you published today, Joanna, is that there's actually this huge, strange industry that buys and sells those reviews. So, Joanna, just tell us the story. How did you get into thinking about getting into the world of reviews, and what did you find?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty simple, actually. I reviewed the Facebook portal, which is Facebook's new creepy home camera thing, a couple of weeks ago, and I tweeted about how, wow, there's 36 reviews on this product, which is 36 more than people that I thought would actually buy it. And then people tweeted back to me being like, well, I'm not really sure these reviews are real. And I didn't really look into if those specific ones were real. But I did notice under one of the reviews on that page that there was a marker that said, you know, this is a Vine member's product review. And Vine is a program. And I clicked into it. And it was like, Vine is a program where Amazon provides free products to these reviewers or buyers and exchange for a free product, which, you know, seemed like a little bit like I didn't even know this went on. And then the more I started looking into it, it turns out that there's this huge underground world. I would say it's a little bit of a shady world where companies or sellers are paying for positive reviews. So I want to just quickly make a distinction. Vine is a program through Amazon where companies or sellers provide products to a buyer or a reviewer, and they don't ask for a positive or negative review, obviously. They just say, please review this product. We're going to give it to you for free. We want to know what you think of it. Please put it on Amazon. But then there's
And that idea by itself, by the way, doesn't strike me as bad. I can see how that could be fine. They're like, we have lots of things we need people to tell us if they're any good, and that'll be useful for other buyers, right? Like, was that your impression?
That was my impression. I mean, at first, I was like, this is a little bit shady, right? Like, do these people give positive reviews because they're getting free products, right? Like, if you don't actually pay the money for it, maybe you're not going to be as honest or straight down the middle in a review as you should. But look, I also felt that way. And actually, in the video piece that I did, I ended up tracking down one of these Vine reviewers, and she's rated 234 on Amazon's reviewers list, and she has reviewed 1,500 products on Amazon over the years.
It's insane.
She spends a lot of her time playing with things and testing them, quote unquote, in some weird, you know, one of the things she showed me was how she tested a tissue. you know, she blew her nose in it. But the other area, which is it is extremely shady, and Amazon and Facebook crack down on these individuals and these groups, is where positive product reviews are being traded for free products or in some cases money. And that's a company or a seller comes along. They say, here, I'll give the example that I talk about in my review. I went through this process in one of the Facebook groups, joined this Facebook group, clicked on a weird looking cat and dog fountain. I contacted them and they wrote back to me and said, if you go here and buy our product, please review it with 5 stars, take pictures, write a certain amount of words about it. Must be a positive review. After you do that, we'll credit you back for the product. Obviously didn't do that. I did get the product in, and my dog seems to actually like drinking out of this weird fountain.
Does all of this exist because all of these companies know that people do like what I do which is just go on, look at the thing with the most good reviews and buy that thing? Like, is that what everybody does on Amazon? Is that the problem now?
Yeah. I mean, Amazon itself says millions of purchases and millions of consumers every day decide based on star ratings. It makes or breaks a product. And as I said in the piece, like, this became far more important when more products flooded Amazon. This is even more important now when you consider that people are buying through Alexa and you say, you know, Alexa, get me the best popcorn, right? And she returns the number one 5-star review on popcorn. And so you end up buying that.
Yeah. And I've been told by the folks who are help these companies market this stuff on Amazon that, you know, getting the buy box is make or break. It's do or die for these products. And then there's that Amazon's choice designation, mm-hmm. which, of course, that's an algorithm too.
I would do a search for some of the products we were looking for, and some of the first search results that would come up, click on those very clearly fake or artificially, you know, increased reviews.
So how do we combat this?
More specifically, like, how has Amazon not solved this problem?
Interestingly, in the reporting, when I first started spotting some of these fakes about a week ago, I did contact the companies. I'd never heard back from any of the companies themselves. Many of them, I think, are based in China, and just, you know, they have click farms that are posting these reviews. They are clearly going through the Facebook group. So nobody responded there. But then actually, by the time we published the piece, many of those fake reviews had been pulled down. And Amazon said that they had caught them in their algorithms or through their daily scrape of signals. They have signals that look for certain things. That's also something I wrote in the piece, right? We can always be on the lookout for those signals. So one of the things that indicates like a legit fake review would be that all the reviews are posted on the same day or around the same day. All of those reviews are 5-star reviews.
Boy, that's a lot of work, though.
Yeah.
Somebody said this to me the other day. They said, like, the universal rule of the internet is that if you create an algorithm that filters things for you, someone is going to create an algorithmic approach to hacking it, and then, like, the battle will never end.
Google's SEO all over again, right?
Right. And yeah. It seems like if they're using algorithms to combat this problem, well, maybe just sort of figure out an algorithmic way to recommend products we should buy.
Ultimately, Facebook's solution was, hey, we're going to hire tens of thousands more humans to review all this. The last time I checked, like, that is the only, like, totally foolproof solution, because any algorithm can always be fooled. Like, you actually want to bet on the humans.
Actually, Amazon's hiring a lot of people. They have two new offices going up right near us. You know, if there's a company that can fight this problem with humans, seems like this would be one of the companies.
Can I just point out that it's a totally perverse incentive here? It's like, hey, we've filled our site with fake and broken stuff that you're not going to bother to return because it's such a pain. But here's this house brand over here that you can trust. It's like, that's kind of sinister, right?
Yeah, I mean, you mean so Amazon just ends up making all the products?
Yeah, the rest of the site you can't really trust.
It seems like if I'm a person who is getting free stuff in exchange for reviewing it, that's actually kind of a sweet deal.
Let me just drop a little anecdote on you. My own sister was at one point an Amazon top 500 reviewer.
Really?
And she became like the number one reviewer for all the gluten-free stuff on the site. And this was like in the early days of gluten-free. And so she would write these reviews. She was really trying to help other people who had the same health difficulties. Yeah. So people are, as you say, performing a vital function. And then in a way, she was helping herself because it's like, okay, well, I get to try this stuff out.
We could talk about Amazon reviews forever. And now I kind of want to go get free stuff.
Facebook groups have been shut down. You can't get in.
It's okay. They're all going to migrate to, you know, WhatsApp now. So it'll be fine. Sure. I'll get in on the ground floor of the next one. So let's talk about Facebook, which is, as best I can tell, maybe the only company more in the news right now than Amazon. They're in this like amazing race to see who gets covered more. But basically, it's the end of 2018, and Facebook has had this wild, insane year of just scandal after scandal about how it collects and shares all of its users' data about 2 billion plus people. And so it felt like now is a good time to look back at all those stories and try to figure out what they all actually mean for us as people and users. How bad is all of this? Does any of it matter? Should we be quitting Facebook? And how did it happen? So to help us answer all of this, I'm going to go get Deepa Seetharaman from our newsroom. So hold on. I'll be right back.
That is fascinating that your sister was such a high-rated Amazon reviewer.
It totally blew my mind when she told me. I was like, what are you? It was like she had told me she had a secret life. I was like, what are you talking about?
Hi, Deepa.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for coming back.
Yeah.
So the story now is how much more your data on Facebook was being used than anybody realized. People are talking about it now, but you've been reporting on this for like months.
Yeah. So I think there's a difference between understanding and knowing. I think a lot of people understood that their data was sort of swimming around out there and that they had given Facebook certain permissions, but they weren't really clear as to the mechanics of it. And that's kind of what the Cambridge Analytica issue brought up, right? Was so suddenly what, they're getting my political affiliations, my political beliefs? Mm. So back in June, my colleague Kirsten and I wrote a story about how Facebook, in addition to giving developers all this information, we're also giving special access to RBC, like the Royal Bank of Canada, and Microsoft, and all these other companies that are companies you and I have heard of, companies that you and I use, you know, but that nobody realized that they were getting this extra level of information.
So what were they getting? Like, in addition to, you know, I feel like everybody is at this point where like, okay, everybody has my email and my home address or whatever, but like, what else were these people getting?
So in a case like Apple, for example, they would get phone numbers, right? Which Facebook had, but didn't give your standard developer, and they gave it to Apple. Now, we asked Apple about this back in June, and they said, well, that information was just stored on the device. We didn't really get it, but it's still a service that was provided to Apple users through Facebook. And these two big tech companies decided to, like, agreed upon this data sharing, and a user didn't know, right? And so the same thing with Bing, right? Microsoft Bing, you got information, posts, pictures, friends' names, all kinds of information that, you know, maybe you trust Microsoft, but you didn't know that this was going to happen. And so Kirsten and I have been reporting on these particular deals all year. A lot of it culminated in the, I don't know if you remember, but back in the dark days, that was early December, there was a
10,000 years
ago. Right, 10,000 years ago. There was a big document dump out of the UK Parliament that explained how Facebook contemplated giving special deals and special access to information and to certain companies. And then this week, the New York Times advanced that reporting further and described 150 deals. And in some cases, some of these developers had access to messages.
Yeah, wasn't it like Netflix could delete your Facebook messages, which is like, and they, I'm sure didn't or whatever, but like, it's wild that that is a thing that was out there.
It's what's, so here's the thing that's a little bit confusing about the situation. And I think this speaks to this broader confusion in general. Like, nobody understands how these systems work. The way that Facebook explains it, so take that how you will, but the way Facebook explains it is, you know, they had to give Netflix these kinds of permissions to allow you, David, to do these kinds, to send these kinds of messages. That if it didn't, if Netflix didn't have the power to write a message, then you couldn't write a message. What if I didn't decide to write a message? Could Netflix write a message on my behalf?
Right.
Like, these are the kinds of questions that aren't necessarily getting answered, because, in part because some of it is, this is how software works, and these is how these platforms work, and it's loose and confusing. And then partly because all the companies are insisting, we didn't know we had this power, and also we didn't abuse it. Well, how do we know that?
Right. Well, and even if it's true, it says, it's like on a whole different plane, sort of wild to me, that these companies weren't asking for the kind of power that Facebook was giving them. Like, if they had this kind of access to people's data and had no interest in it, that's almost more frightening to me. That just means it's sort of out there to be used by someone who's not paying attention. Like, that just seems crazy.
100%. Like, how do you know who's checking this stuff? Like, who is actually the gatekeeper for this information? And that's the part that really freaks people out.
But the feeling is that all these developers, they knew they had this data.
A lot of them knew. And then in some cases, they didn't realize they could get the data, right? This is the Netflix argument. And RBC told us something similar this year, too. They're like, what do you mean we didn't have access to this data? I guess if we had access, we had no idea.
Right. It's like they didn't build systems to do anything with it.
And so maybe there is no abuse, but
yeah,
there are also no laws. There's no checks and balances. So I don't think that comforts people.
Over the course of this past year, as the story has gotten
crazier
and bigger and broader, that Facebook's response has been basically the same to every single one, which is like, well, you know, it didn't affect that many people, and it you know, we stopped it years ago. And now I feel like we've reached this point where both of those things are categorically false.
Yeah.
Like it affected lots and lots of people, and they were doing it on purpose. Like, I almost take issue with the idea that this was negligence. Like, they were giving these companies your data on purpose. That feels scarier to me, where it's like the company did this because they wanted to.
I always think about when Kirsten and I wrote our story in June about the data deals, they told us we didn't have the total number, and they said it was a small number. Mm. And then this week, the Times with internal documents says it's 150.
Small relative to all the companies in the universe.
Yeah, right. So what are we?
They were like number one and two tech companies in the world.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, yes, it's maybe 150 companies relative to hundreds of thousands is small. Sure. But we're not talking about small. They're not small companies.
Right, they're not like food trucks that are getting Facebook data.
How do you fix it? That's the goal, right? Like Mark Zuckerberg started out this year saying, I want to fix Facebook. I'm going to fix some of these issues.
How many more billion people? I think of them as like uncontacted tribes who are going to get onto WhatsApp, and then there's going to be no end to the stories about how this was a part of some just awful, lynching in India, ethnic cleansing in Myanmar. Like, it just seems like that keeps happening, because what happens is people get these devices, they get these sort of rumor machines, and there's no media literacy. You know, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook own that tragedy.
One of the things they're trying to do is put on plays throughout India, like, because there's low literacy. So one of the key features of WhatsApp is audio. So you just trade audio messages with one another. I do not know what their plan is for policing that and for content review around audio messages.
When you said plays, I thought you meant like the theater.
No, I do mean plays that they are staging throughout India to try to get people to use WhatsApp better, differently.
Wow.
And to like,
what does that look like?
Both innovative and just sounds like
what?
Just so tragic. Like they like, oops, like we thought AI was going to solve this, but no, we realized that we are
it's the theater.
truly stuck.
Okay, so coming up in a few minutes, my interview with Gary Hustwit about the state of product design and where all of it goes from here. But first, it's almost Christmas, and you, like me, probably have more stuff to buy. I actually have an Amazon page open with reviews I no longer trust with stuff I have to buy. So we each, in order to help, came up with a cheap, easy, readily available thing you can buy for less than $50. Mims, I feel like you were the most excited about yours. You go first.
If you want to surprise and delay people, I'm your man. So the thing that people have not realized
give
is
the gift
thing
of Mims.
Yet, battery-powered garments that heat you. So there's hats, there's socks, there's a vest if you want to warm your core. They have these large, like 5,000 milliamp hour flat battery packs. You recharge them, and they will keep you warm for up to 10 hours. And I just feel like I know a lot of people who are cold all the time. And if you want the cheap version, get them like a $20, $25 USB hand warmer.
Isn't there a 100% chance that this thing is going to burn me alive?
Yes, I was just thinking about that.
It'll help you maintain your tan. No, not unless it's defective.
You know the scene, I think it's Home Alone, where they set, what's his name, on fire?
Now it would just be a battery-powered hat
that
sets you on fire.
Kevin just gives him that, and then he just has a thing in his pocket and it like turns him on fire.
What's yours?
Mine? Well, I was told it can't be a password manager and it can't be a phone charger because those are my go-tos. So if you haven't gotten those already, you should get them. But this other one is completely free in the sense that you don't spend any money, but you spend time. And so the idea is that if you're going home to visit your parents, or it doesn't have to be even your parents. I don't like the idea that your parents might not be tech savvy. You may be around someone who's not very tech savvy. Could even be your brother, your sister, your cat. You give the time, you give the gift of your time to help them with a tech problem they may have. So this year, I feel like that tech problem may be, I'm giving all this information to Facebook. I don't know where it is. Can you help me with that? And you give a 30 minutes, an hour. It's a little card. You make it. You print it out. Maybe you just write it on a little piece of paper, an IOU. And that's the gift.
So you get like a gift card for 1 hour of family IT support.
Yeah, that's a good way of summarizing it. Thank
you.
Can we
be more direct? Why is the gift not you install parental controls on their computer and use those to block Facebook?
Perfect idea.
Fair.
If that's how you want to go at it, do that. If you want to show them how to buy things on Amazon and field out fake reviews, do that.
So tech support, you're giving them tech support. So in the old days, you would give, you know, you'd give them a certificate for like a free back rub.
Right.
But now it's tech support.
Yes. You used to give, I used to give my mom every like Mother's Day a breakfast in bed.
Oh, yeah.
I never free did hugs. That. Mm. You know what? I never did. I owe her so many of those now. I should probably do that this holiday season. But this seems like something you might actually do even without giving them that. So it's even like a free gift to yourself.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
It's like an hour. It's like a free hour of being pedantic and no one can interrupt you.
Right.
I agree. I mean, how often do we, everybody has this. We go home, people don't know how to use their phones, and you're like, look, this is called Venmo.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we should suggest Venmo after episode whatever that we did a couple of weeks ago, but yeah.
True. Square Cash. Yeah.
Yeah. Or just cash.
Okay.
Oh, a coupon for cash. I feel like we've, now you're getting slightly away from it. Okay. Mine is a pop socket, which I believe everyone on earth should own several of. I've recently become a pop socket convert, which if anyone doesn't know, it's those little nubs you put on the back of your phone that make it easier to hold. And they're just the greatest thing. They look sort of ridiculous and they make wireless charging not work, which is a shame. But just the thing where you're not doing that weird thing with your pinky underneath your phone to prop it up and it hurts after a while and you like drop it every time you try to reach up for the top of the phone is just wonderful. And pop sockets are like $10. You can get a mount that goes in the car that they clip into for like $15. You can get them customized with your dog's face or your face. They're just an awesome thing. I have one on my phone. I put one on my Kindle. I have one on my Nintendo Switch. Just like anything you hold that is these awkward rectangles that actually aren't meant to be held is just way better with a pop socket. And I'm a giant fan, and they're like the perfect stocking stuffer that I'm buying for basically everyone I know who complains about how big their phone is, which is everyone I know.
So I thought they were like just a cult, like selfie sticks. But you're saying they're actually useful. You're saying I should stick one of these on all my devices.
They're incredibly useful. Your phone is bad to hold. It's not. It was not designed to be held. It's been a long time since phones were designed based on being comfortable for humans to have in their hands. But you can use it. You can sort of flip it down and use it as a little stand for your phone. You can use it just to hold. I use it when I'm reading. It's way more comfortable than having to actually like grip the thing hard. It just sort of slides between your fingers. It's wonderful. I used to make fun of people who had pop sockets, and now I am all in on it forever and ever.
Please send us your affiliate link.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm looking
seriously
on Amazon right now. There's tons of pop sockets on here that I'm not sure I would trust the reviews, but which one do you recommend, David?
The official, I think it's called a pop grip from Pop Sockets, is like there's only really one thing and it comes in a lot of different colors and materials, but that's definitely the one to get. I haven't found a knockoff that works yet. So in the spirit of talking about the weirdness of product design now, coming up is my interview with Gary Hustwit about his new documentary, Roms, about the designer Dieter Roms, who might actually hate all of the things that we just told you to buy.
Max Levchin was one of the original co-founders of PayPal, and now he's leading one of the biggest players in the buy now, pay later business. As CEO of a firm, he's going head-to-head with the credit card companies.
Credit, generally speaking, is good. America runs on credit. I think we led ourselves a little astray when we decided that credit cards is the optimal way of borrowing money.
Hear an in-depth version of our conversation with Max Levchin for WSJ's Take on the Week, plus other exclusive content on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back. A couple of weeks ago, I went to a screening in San Francisco of Roms, a new documentary about Dieter Roms from the filmmaker Gary Hustwit. Gary's made a few documentaries before, but he's probably best known for a film called Helvetica, which, despite being a whole movie about a font, is actually a great look at how something so simple can change the way you experience the world. This time, Gary focuses his work on one person, Dieter Roms. He's probably the most celebrated product designer of the last century, both in the products he made at Braun and in the way he inspired other designers to follow in his minimalist, honest style. Roms also developed what he called the 10 Principles of Good Design, which includes things like good design makes a product useful, and good design makes a product understandable, and good design is thorough down to the last detail, and good design is as little design as possible. And he had this great phrase to describe everything he did: less, but better. Gary told me he'd been thinking about making a movie with Roms, who's now 86, for years. He met him while filming a brief scene for another documentary called Objectified. And he had this sense that Dieter Roms had a lot more to talk about.
You know, as a designer and as the leader of the design department at Braun from the, you know, early 60s to the mid 90s, he oversaw the design of just so many kind of iconic products that we've all used. I mean, if you've used an Oral-B toothbrush or a Braun razor or a Braun coffee maker or an alarm clock or a juicer, just all the kind of consumer electronics products that Braun put out, you've come into contact with Dieter Roms, even if you didn't realize it. And then he's subsequently influenced, you know, people like Jonathan Ive at Apple. Both Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive were you know, always talking about how much Roms was an inspiration to them. And you can definitely look at a lot of Apple's products and see that influence. But yet, if you talk to Dieter, you know, he looks back at his career and he now regrets being a designer because he feels like he's contributed to this over-consumerized, you know, throwaway culture where design is just, you know, it doesn't have the kind of idealism that it had in the, you know, post-World War II Germany, where people were trying to make honest products and make things more democratic. You know, it's turned into just about profit and about completely unsustainable. So he feels like the work that he did and his design teams did somehow is, you know, part of that evolution to kind of where we are now with this unsustainable system. So I think that's a really interesting contradiction. And then I think he's got a lot of really timely ideas about how technology has changed our behavior, and specifically digital technology, which he famously, you know, basically has opted out of. He doesn't have a computer. He doesn't have the internet.
So he never uses a computer or a phone or anything. It's really impressive. Like, to actually be able to avoid all that stuff is not easy.
Yeah, I mean, he reads the newspaper and he has an Olivetti Valentine typewriter that he uses to type his correspondence still. Again, that's the way it's, you know, that's how he's happy communicating. He has an iPhone, which was given to him by Johnny Ive and the Apple design team, but it basically just kind of sits on his desk like a paperweight. He doesn't actually use it, but he's incredibly well informed. I mean, again, he reads the newspaper and he's really curious, but he just doesn't feel like he needs to participate. He's been kind of, you know, watching the past, you know, 20, 25 years as digital technology has become a bigger part of our life and is basically really looking at it in horror.
Yeah, one of my favorite shots of the whole film was he's on a street corner, I think in London, and like the bus goes by and you see him through the window and he's the only person sort of looking back at the camera while everyone else is looking down at their phone. It was such a like incredible little microcosm of him. It was great.
Yeah, no, I think he looks like he's from another planet or something.
Mm-hmm.
He just kind of stands out. You know, I put him there at that corner, which is in like Oxford Circus in London, which is one of the busiest intersections in the world. It's one of the busiest shopping districts in the world. I just knew it would make him uncomfortable to be there, so I sort of intentionally put him there, and then, you know, filmed him from afar as he sort of, you know, looked around in amazement at you know, what was going on.
So what do you make of that? I mean, one of the things that was so striking to me about the film was that it's full of these people who are so in awe of everything that Dieter believed in, and they love his principles and, you know, his famous less but better thing everybody talks about all the time. And yet the same people who say those things are making these things that Dieter Roms himself is now sort of revolting against. It's like everybody took his principles and then sort of turned them inside out without even meaning to. Like, what do you have a sense of kind of how we got here from there?
I think in some ways the designers and the companies that have been influenced by Roms and that have used his work as inspiration, they've taken only kind of half of it, taken kind of the aesthetic side of what Roms did and kind of used that or evolved that, you know, with their products, but they didn't take kind of the ethics side of it. Because you could arguably say that, like, Apple is the, you know, again, one of the companies that has most been influenced by his work and whose products kind of, you know, at least visually owe a big debt to Roms' designs. Again, it's for Roms, it goes further than just how something looks. It's about how it's produced and how it's disposed of. And, you know, his 10 principles are about a lot of those things. It's not just about the physical design of the object. It's kind of a bigger picture, holistic view of product design. So, again, I think a lot of companies are maybe taking the kind of the aesthetic side and not really thinking about the ethics of it.
Was that the kind of stuff that he was talking about when he said if he could, you know, do it all over again, he wouldn't be a designer again? Like, what did you make of that?
I think he feels like his work and his influence have played a role in kind of getting to where our society is now. And he trained as an architect and wanted to be a landscape architect or an urban planner. He got kind of swept up when the management at Brown just recognized his talent and kind of got him into product design, and he was great at it, and, you know, that just kind of took off. But I think in his heart, he really still wants to be a landscape architect. I mean, I get a couple inquiries a week from companies that want to try to get a hold of him to design their eyewear collection or a new razor or something. And he has no interest in that. I mean, I think it's the same thing with the digital world. You know, he doesn't use a cell phone. He doesn't have a computer. He's not on social media. I mean, it's just he has no interest at all. His whole career has been about simplicity and trying to simplify people's lives and simplify his own life. And you can look at digital technology and you can say that it's given us some pretty amazing capabilities, but you cannot say it has simplified our lives.
But on the other hand, I mean, it's almost sort of a shame that someone like him would not look at that world and say, okay, we've gone down some weird roads. Maybe it's time to figure out how to do it better. Because it feels like we're in a moment of technology where a lot of bad ideas have been tried and found out to be bad ideas. And we've gone down some pretty wrong roads, and we're in need of somebody to come in and kind of lay out principles and ideas and push people in directions that are both sort of right and modern.
Just redesign the internet, basically.
Yeah, scratch. Super easy.
No problem.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll get him right on that.
He's still young. He could handle
it. He just doesn't care. And at the same point, his principles and his philosophies and his ideas can be applied to digital technology. I think those 10 principles are kind of adaptable to a lot of different disciplines of design. So I think people can use his principles to try to, and they do try to make things better with the principles. I mean, you know, this idea of trying to simplify interaction design and user experience design, I think is key. I mean, there's so much noise and so much clutter in our digital lives that needs to be simplified. So again, he's not going to do it, but I think that designers and engineers and programmers who use his principles as a mantra, you know, could improve things. That was something I wanted to show in the film. I just wanted to show what he was about, the ideas that he had, and the kind of commitment to the environment, you know, that he's always had. And just try to get some of these ideas, you know, especially the kind of less but better idea, more into the public discourse. It's like, do we need all this stuff? Like, why do we think we need all this stuff that we buy and throw away? You know, for Dieter, it's really about trying to kind of simplify things and take a step back and reassess the direction that we're going in.
So do you think one of the sort of threads of Helvetica was basically that Helvetica was so popular that a bunch of people revolted against it and started doing like the opposite, these weird, wild, one-off typefaces. And then It kind of went back around the other way to revolting against that. Like, are we going to end up back in the Dieter Rams way of thinking? Like, is this all going to come full circle on us the same way?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's like a pendulum swinging one way or the other, you know? Like we've gotten all this kind of amazing new stuff that's, you know, all these digital developments and the abilities that kind of the internet and digital, like, have given us. And I think we've very much rushed to kind of embrace everything that comes down the pipe. And now maybe we're like, oh, maybe it's not such a good idea to, you know, just blindly believe everything that we see in social media. And, you know, now I feel like we're in that middle of that kind of maybe just a little bit of a recalibration and a kind of swing back a little bit.
So, and how much do you feel like Dieter himself has spent time thinking about his
legacy. He struck me as the kind of person watching the film that doesn't want to spend a ton of time sort of considering his place in the universe.
That's a good point. He doesn't have a real sense of his impact or his influence on other designers. I think it's just the nature of his personality. Yeah, you know, I noticed a lot of similarities between him and Johnny Ive at Apple. They're both just diehard engineers. They want to be in the shop. They want to be in the workshop. They want to be kind of experimenting with materials. And, you know, they don't want to be out giving press conferences and, you know, promoting themselves. In that sense, Dieter, in a lot of ways, I think, is not a household name because he just wasn't out there sort of, you know, pushing himself and kind of being, you know, being in the spotlight. Like, he just wanted a really simple life and liked designing these things and liked working with his design team. And that's all he really cared about. So in some ways, I think he has a lot of great observations about the design world in general, a lot of opinions about what he doesn't like in design. But I don't think he has a good sense of his impact in the bigger picture. And it's one of the things that the film can kind of demonstrate in some ways.
Roms is now available to rent online at hustwit.com, H-U-S-T-W-I-T.com. And it's really great. I definitely recommend seeing. Anyway, that's our show. Thanks to Gary, Deepa, Joanna, and Christopher for being here. And thank you, as always, for listening. We're off next week for the holiday, but normally have new episodes on Fridays. So make sure you're subscribed to Instant Message on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you listen. If you have feedback or ideas, as always, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon. Happy holidays.